Hello and welcome to NewsHour from the BBC World Service with Julian Marshall in London and me, James Kamara-Sami, in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. And it was the result in this Midwestern state, announced at 4:30 a.m. local time, that took Donald Trump over the line and back into the White House at the end of a momentous election campaign. A short while ago, his Democratic opponent, Kamala Harris, called the president-elect to concede. We are expecting her to give a public concession speech, the first public comment she's made since that defeat. Pretty soon we will bring them to you as and when she makes them. She had, of course, hoped to be the history maker, the first woman in the Oval Office, the first person of mixed South Asian and black heritage to become America's commander-in-chief. Instead, it is Mr. Trump who has rewritten the history books and, for now at least, redrawn America's political map, getting the young out to vote, doing much better among Latino voters than in the past. In fact, doing pretty well amongst all sections of American society. The 45th president of the United States will now also be the 47th, the first time that anyone has won non-consecutive U.S. elections since Grover Cleveland in 1892. At 78, he'll also be the oldest person to be inaugurated in January after his opponent, Kamala Harris, has one of her final bitter jobs as vice president in the U.S. Congress, where she will officially declare Donald Trump the next president. He will, of course, also be the first convicted felon to hold the job. Well, in this edition of NewsHour, coming live from Solly's Grill, a diner in northern Milwaukee, we have been inhabiting for the last few days with a love to have their butter burgers. I can see people chomping on them right now. We will be looking at why Donald Trump won this election. We'll get reaction to the result from the US and across the world. We'll also ask what a second term might look like. Will it be Trump unbound, as some have suggested? And if so, what could that look like? What will it mean? Well, this is what Mr. Trump promised at his campaign headquarters in Palm Beach, Florida overnight.
This will truly be the golden age of America. That's what we have to have. Together we can truly make America great again for all Americans. So I want to just tell you what a great honor this is. I want to thank you. I will not let you down. America's future will be bigger, better, bolder, richer, safer, and stronger than it has ever been before. God bless you and God bless America. Thank you very much. Thank you very much.
Well, here with me in Solly's Grill, it's double horseshoe-shaped counters, filling up again. They were quiet for a while, but it's now the mid-afternoon rush. Professor Julia Azari, political scientist at Marquette University here in Milwaukee. It's at another university that Kamala Harris is going to be speaking shortly, Howard, her alma mater, of course. What do you suspect? We don't know what she's going to say, but the tone of it, what are you expecting?
Yeah, I mean, I certainly expect a somber tone. I also expect that she'll try to bring some of the characteristic joy that she was known for throughout the campaign. I think her supporters will be looking for that. I also think this is an opportunity. We'll see if she takes it to talk about the importance of concession and to get in maybe one last dig at Donald Trump and reference to 2020. I think this is a moment when politicians give these concession speeches to really talk about these broader values of democracy and the peaceful transfer of power.
Do you think history will say that she lost the election or that Donald Trump won it?
Oh, fascinating question. I think what we're seeing now, I think we'll see a lot that Trump won it. But I also think that there will be a lot of conversation over the next few months about what Harris and the Democrats could have done differently.
Well, look, thanks very much for that. We'll be hearing more from you, Julia, later on in the program. But let's hear from some of the customers here at Solly's. I've been getting reaction to the election result from some of those who had come here for lunch. I did get reaction. Unfortunately, that tape doesn't appear to be ready to go. So we're going to hear from somebody else, someone who is close to Donald Trump, Chris Ruddy. He's CEO of the conservative news organization Newsmax. He's a longtime friend of the president-elect. I spoke to him just as he was about to board a flight, and he told me he had spoken to Mr. Trump just after his victory speech last night.
At about 3 a.m. in the morning, we had a phone call We spoke for about 5 minutes. He was really excited. He was tired, he told me, but he was very excited about the plans that he has for the country. And he thinks he has a really important job. And he referenced in the conversation the assassination attempt and that he had survived it and that it gave him a lot of meaning to what he needed to do.
What can you share about those plans?
Well, you should ask him what his plans are.
I don't think he's going to talk to me today, Chris. You are, though.
But I can tell you that in the conversations I've had with him, he's very concerned about the international situation. We've had a meltdown with China and the Taiwan situation. Korea seems to be right on the edge. And then you have the Ukraine war, the first major war in Europe, the Middle East with Iran. So the world is on fire. And I think he feels this is where he can make a difference. He's supportive of Ukraine. This thing that he's against Ukraine is nonsense. He supports President Zelensky. They had a very good meeting in New York. He liked him when he was president of the United States. Previously, he liked Zelensky. So he understands, but he also wants to get a peace agreement.
Yeah, well, does he have a plan?
Well, in his mind, he has a plan, and he's laid out the rough edges of that, which is to let both sides know they have to come to the table, and the side that doesn't come to the table gets penalized. And he wants a discussion and a negotiation. And he thinks there needs to be a settlement. So I foresee, now he hasn't told me this, I foresee that he's going to continue in arming the Ukrainians pretty significantly. That's not going to stop. He's going to continue giving aid to Ukraine. That's not going to stop. He will probably reach out to the Russians. By the way, I think it was not true that he had all these conversations. That was just made up stuff. He
did
not have. Yeah, I believe that is not true. And for a number of reasons, I believe it's not true. In any event, I think he's going to come in here with a positive thought. I know some people think that he's going to be on some vengeance tour or something. I don't see that. I think he will be trying to get his agenda. He only has 4 years.
Well, he has, Chris. He has talked about retribution. I saw posters here in Wisconsin, Revenge 2024. It was part of the pitch, wasn't it?
Well, he also says, let's fight these people, let's knock them out. He uses rhetoric that's a little hyper. I think there's a very significant judicial system we have in the country that's not going to allow the targeting. I do think most people agree, and I think it was one of the reasons he won, especially black men, felt like he was targeted by the justice system as they believe they have been, and that it was judicial overreach. I don't think he wants to do the same thing. I could be wrong. I don't believe that we'll have that same issue.
I know you have believed from the start that he would, A, be the candidate for the Republicans when others doubted it and would win. This, though, is an extraordinary comeback, isn't it? Put this into some kind of historical context.
Well, it's funny. Last night, I said this wasn't the comeback in U.S. history, which J.D. Vance remarked in his statement last night, that this is the biggest comeback in the history of the United States. I said to President Trump that this is the biggest comeback in the history of the world. And he laughed and he said, well, I'm not really coming back, he said to me. And it's not a comeback. And I said, no, it's a comeback. And you're coming back big. And I definitely think it's a historical thing. And I think that it's amazing what he has done and what he has continued to do.
I'm just getting my head around the fact, Chris, you out-hyperboled President Trump.
Well, I'm a journalist, and maybe we occasionally are given to a little rhetoric that's over the top, too.
Chris Ruddy, friend of Donald Trump, CEO of the conservative news organization Newsmax. Still waiting to see Kamala Harris make her appearance. There is a lectern there at Howard University waiting for her. We'll bring it when we can. But let's bring now what we hoped to a few minutes ago, but we can, some reaction to the election result that I gleaned from customers who had come to this place, Solly's Grill, for lunch.
Well, I'm Dale from the Wisconsin area.
And this is your wife?
My dear wife.
Sandy. And this is the best Butterburger in Wisconsin.
More publicity for Solly's. They're going to absolutely love us.
Great.
Now, tell us, we've had a presidential election. Donald Trump is going to be president again. How do you feel about that?
Well, as a businessman, he will straighten his country out. As a person with a personality, he's not the easiest person to put your arm around and like. But he gets the job done. And the same thing, I compare it to like a surgeon. If I'm going to go have surgery, I don't care if the guy's got 6 fingers on each hand. If he's the best surgeon, I want him. For me, he's the best guy out there.
So you're sitting on the fence.
Yeah. Really.
So look, you're from Wisconsin. You know, this state, it's always so close. It was close again.
Oh, yeah.
Yesterday, 1%. Yeah. In it, less than 1%, I think. What do you say to the other 50% then, who are now in mourning, think this is the end of the world?
Well, if they quit calling us names and labeling us, that might help. And if you call me a deplorable, it's like, well, what did I do? I voted for the person I believed was a better choice. You don't call me all kinds of names about it or tell me you're going to leave the country. And they don't leave. That's the problem. You know, I'm willing to chip in to ship them out of here and send them over to Venezuela, wherever else they want to go. But
I want to bring you in. I know you're standing there. But I mean, what is your take on why he is one, why he is a popular president for you?
Because of his energy. He will talk to anybody and open up to anybody, and people feel like they can understand him.
He's a 78-year-old guy, the oldest person to be elected president. He's going to keep that energy up for 4 years, do you think?
Well, my husband's only 68, and Donald Trump has 10 times more energy than him.
Want some more coffee, honey? There you go.
My name is Cornelius Whiteside.
And how do you feel about this election result?
I'm surprised that with all of the outstanding issues with Donald Trump, the court cases, and him never conceding that he did lose a race from the 2020 election, kind of surprised. Our country is really divided.
What do you think is going to happen?
I'm waiting to see, because he was really being hostile, and now he says he's going to bring everybody together.
You sound skeptical.
I have my reservations.
Some views from Solly's Grill here in Milwaukee. Still waiting for Kamala Harris. While we're waiting, Professor Julia Zari, political scientist at Marquette University, is with me. Where do you think and how was this election won, Julia?
Sure. So right now, as we're looking at some of the exit polls and vote totals, there are a few things that seem clear. One is that Trump generally improved across a lot of different groups, and it seems that Harris has likely improved with white college-educated voters, but she hasn't improved as much with that group as Trump has with other groups, including Latinos. The other piece of it is that Democrats are very strong in urban areas, and Republicans are very strong in rural areas, but there's kind of an imbalance and asymmetry across those two areas of strength, with Republicans simply drawing, with Trump drawing bigger margins in rural areas than Harris was able to in urban.
Did she just not have enough time to define herself in a campaign?
That's certainly a possibility. It's really hard to know what this would have looked like under other circumstances. We certainly did hear a lot about that throughout the campaign and in the last day. I think, though, one thing that would have been a problem under any circumstance is the kind of vice presidency curse. Her experience, her claim to running for office, really is very much rooted in her experience as vice president. That made it very difficult to distance herself from some of the more unpopular aspects of the Biden administration.
Interesting. Well, look, we still await Kamala Harris's concession speech. Julia, thanks for the time being for being with us. Professor Julia Azari, a political scientist at Marquette University here in Milwaukee. You're listening to NewsHour with Julian Marshall in London and me, James Kamarasamy in Wisconsin.
And coming up, we hear why the Hispanic vote came out so strongly in support of Donald Trump.
You know, even middle class, I'm middle class, even, you know, I'm hurting because all the food prices, everything's up, you know, taxes is up. I can't imagine, you know, for blue collar workers, you know, what they're going through. The American people have woken up and they're seeing through the lies that the Democrat Party constantly give us.
And a reminder of our top headline, Mr. Trump, now the president-elect of the United States, has been congratulated by his defeated rival, Kamala Harris, as the country and the world digest his seismic election victory. We're currently waiting for Kamala Harris to make her public concession speech at Howard University in Washington. This is NewsHour with James Kumarasamy in Wisconsin and me, Julian Marshall, in London. More than 70 million Americans voted for Donald Trump to become their next president, hoping for a different, if not better, future. But what could this second Trump presidency mean for the rest of the world? Leaders have been congratulating him, some more effusively than others. Among the first was Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, who described Mr. Trump's victory as history's greatest comeback. During his first presidency, the two men worked together to secure normalization agreements between Israel and two Gulf states, agreements known as the Abraham Accords. But the Middle East landscape looks very different today. More than 42,000 people have been killed in Israel's war against Hamas in Gaza. Here's how some Gazans reacted today to a new face in the White House.
I don't care whether Trump, Biden, or anyone else wins. I just want someone who will spare us from all of this. I need a strong character who will draw a line between us and the Jews. It's enough. We've lost our livelihoods and have been suffering from killings and starvation. What's left for us? Nothing.
God willing, we hope that Trump will act. Not for us, but for the sake of the little children caught up in this war and dying of hunger.
Well, Israel is also now engaged in an offensive against Hezbollah in Lebanon, also resulting in a large loss of civilian life. And there's been an exchange of missile fire in recent weeks between Israel and Iran. Boaz Bismuth is a member of parliament of the ruling Likud party. How does Israel view the prospect of a second Trump presidency?
Well, in fact, of a remake, I would say, because as you know, President Trump was already the 45th president, so you know what you can expect. And he was a very friendly president to Israel. During his first mandate, I mean, don't forget the transfer of the American embassy to Jerusalem, which was something that Israel waited for decades. Don't forget also the recognition of the Golan Heights. And especially, I would say that the most important thing for Israelis is the restart in the Middle East, the day after the war ends. And when I say a restart in the Middle East, I put the emphasis on the restart of the Abraham Accords made by President Trump.
So you would expect under Mr. Trump an expansion of those Abraham Accords in which Israel makes its peace with a number of other Arab countries?
I think that the Abraham Accords were very realistic. I would say that if, I mean, you do think or speak again of a new Middle East, the Abraham Accords are really the accords that can make the difference and maybe bring us really security, stability, and of course, peace. But for that, you need, first of all, to end the war. And when I speak of ending the war, you know, President Trump in his first speech, he spoke, of course, of the fact that he doesn't start war, he ends them. And remember, you and me, that in his first mandate, you had zero wars.
But you're talking here about a man, Mr. Trump, who has said that he will end the war in Gaza before he takes office next January. Has he told Israel how he plans to do that?
First of all, I wish, and I'll tell you why. Because, I mean, we've got objectives in Gaza. There is no reason after that to continue the war.
I mean, could I put it to you that perhaps one of the attractions of a second Trump presidency for Israel is that he will not ask for the kind of restraint of Israel that the Biden administration has asked? And I'm thinking here very specifically of Israel's targeting of Iran and the reports that the Biden administration very specifically asked you not to target nuclear sites.
Look, with all due respect, I think that President Trump knows exactly that Iran is not only an enemy of Israel, but an enemy of the world.
Do you think Mr. Trump cares about the Palestinians?
I think he cares about people. Otherwise, he wouldn't go to serve, I mean, his nation. You know, you don't go to politics if you don't like people in general. So yes, he does care about everybody. But for the Palestinians, as you mentioned, first of all, they have to care for themselves and they have to take their responsibility. And I also always say this quote, and I say to you, the day Palestinians will want to have a state more than not wanting the Jews to have one, maybe then we shall be able to go forward in the region. But as much as it's not the case, I mean, we're stuck. We're stuck with the problem.
That was Israeli MP Boaz Bismuth. And let's cross now to Howard University in Washington, D.C., where the defeated U.S. presidential candidate, Kamala Harris, has just approached the lectern and is preparing to speak amid applause from the crowd.
Good afternoon, everyone. Good afternoon. Good afternoon. Good afternoon. Thank you all. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. So let me say, and I love you back. And I love you back. So let me say, My heart is full today. My heart is full today, full of gratitude for the trust you have placed in me, full of love for our country, and full of resolve. The outcome of this election is not what we wanted, not what we fought for, not what we voted for. But hear me when I say, hear me when I say, the light of America's promise will always burn bright as long as we never give up and as long as we keep fighting. To my beloved Doug and our family, I love you so very much. To President Biden and Dr. Biden, thank you for your faith and support. To Governor Walz and the Walz family, I know your service to our nation will continue. And to my extraordinary team, to the volunteers who gave so much of themselves, to the poll workers and the local election officials, I thank you. I thank you all. Look, I am so proud of the race we ran and the way we ran it. And the way we ran it. Over the 107 days of this campaign, we have been intentional about building community and building coalitions, bringing people together from every walk of life and background, united by love of country, with enthusiasm and joy in our fight for America's future. And we did it with the knowledge that we all have so much more in common than what separates us. Now, I know folks are feeling and experiencing a range of emotions right now. I get it. But we must accept the results of this election. Earlier today, I spoke with President-elect Trump and congratulated him on his victory. I also told him that we will help him and his team with their transition, and that we will engage in a peaceful transfer of power.
And you were hearing there the defeated U.S. presidential candidate, Kamala Harris, making a public concession speech in which she said that Americans must accept the result of the election. We'll return as soon as possible. You're listening to the BBC World Service. I'm Julian Marshall in London with James Kumarasamy in Wisconsin. And let's return now to Kamala Harris, who has been giving her public concession speech.
Earlier today, I spoke with President-elect Trump and congratulated him on his victory. I also told him that we will help him and his team with their transition, and that we will engage in a peaceful transfer of power. A fundamental principle of American democracy is that when we lose an election, we accept the results. That principle, as much as any other, distinguishes democracy from monarchy or tyranny. And anyone who seeks the public trust must honor it. At the same time, in our nation, we owe loyalty not to a president or a party, but to the Constitution of the United States. And loyalty to our conscience and to our God. My allegiance to all three is why I am here to say, while I concede this election, I do not concede the fight that fueled this campaign. The fight for freedom, for opportunity, for fairness, and the dignity of all people. A fight for the ideals at the heart of our nation, the ideals that reflect America at our best. That is a fight I will never give up. I will never give up the fight for a future where Americans can pursue their dreams, ambitions, and aspirations, where the women of America have the freedom to make decisions about their own body and not have their government telling them what to do. We will never give up the fight to protect our schools and our streets from gun violence. And America, we will never give up the fight for our democracy, for the rule of law, for equal justice, and for the sacred idea that every one of us, no matter who we are or where we start out, has certain fundamental rights and freedoms that must be respected and upheld.
That was the defeated U.S. presidential candidate Kamala Harris publicly conceding that she had lost.
You're listening to NewsHour with James Kumarasamy in Wisconsin and Julian Marshall in London. Let's return to that concession speech by the defeated candidate in the U.S. election, Kamala Harris.
And we will continue to wage this fight in the voting booth, in the courts, and in the public square. And we will also wage it in quieter ways, in how we live our lives, by treating one another with kindness and respect, by looking in the face of a stranger and seeing a neighbor, by always using our strength to lift people up, to fight for the dignity that all people deserve. The fight for our freedom will take hard work, but like I always say, we like hard work. Hard work is good work. Hard work can be joyful work. And the fight for our country is always worth it. It is always worth it. To the young people who are watching, it is... I love you. To the young people who are watching, it is okay to feel sad and disappointed, but please know it's going to be okay. On the campaign, I would often say, when we fight, we win. But here's the thing. Sometimes the fight takes a while. That doesn't mean we won't win. The important thing is don't ever give up. Don't ever stop trying to make the world a better place. You have power. And don't you ever listen when anyone tells you something is impossible because it has never been done before. You have the capacity to do extraordinary good in the world. And so to everyone who is watching, do not despair. This is not a time to throw up our hands. This is a time to roll up our sleeves. This is a time to organize, to mobilize, and to stay engaged for the sake of freedom and justice and the future that we all know we can build together. Look, many of you know I started out as a prosecutor, and throughout my career, I saw people at some of the worst times in their lives, people who had suffered great harm and great pain, and yet found within themselves the strength and the courage and the resolve to take the stand, to take a stand, to fight for justice, to fight for themselves, to fight for others. So let their courage be our inspiration. Let their determination be our charge. And I'll close with this. There's an adage an historian once called a law of history, true of every society across the ages. The adage is, only when it is dark enough can you see the stars. I know many people feel like we are entering a dark time, but for the benefit of us all, I hope that is not the case. But here's the thing, America, if it is, let us fill the sky with the light of a brilliant, brilliant billion of stars. The light of optimism, of faith, of truth, and service. H.U. And may that work guide us, even in the face of setbacks, toward the extraordinary promise of the United States of America. I thank you all. May God bless you, and may God bless the United States of America. I thank you all.
Kamala Harris, the defeated Democratic candidate in the U.S. presidential election, giving her concession speech at her alma mater, Howard University in Washington. With me here in Wisconsin, in Milwaukee, in Solly's Grill, Professor Julia Azari, political scientist at Marquette University, listening to that with us. Julia, what stood out for you?
Sure. I think what stood out was the theme that has really been a kind of defining theme of the Biden-Harris administration, which is navigating the tension between restoring what they have described as democratic norms and also practicing the kind of normal art of politics and highlighting policy disagreements with the Trump administration and the kind of normal back and forth.
Yeah, and I think you presaged this, but you said that she would probably make a point of saying that she conceded, she accepted the results, and there would be a peaceful transfer of power, contrasting herself with what happened 4 years ago.
Certainly, and that was, I think that line was very pointed. And at the same time, the role of the concession speech really is both to highlight that peaceful transfer of power and to highlight that kind of acceptance of loss, but also to talk about what it will look like to be the opposition party.
Conceding defeat, she said, but not conceding the fight that fueled the campaign. I mean, this was reminiscent to me of her speech back in 2016 when she was just elected to the U.S. Senate on the same night that Hillary Clinton lost to Donald Trump.
Sure. I haven't revisited that speech
but
today.
But the tenor of it saying, look, sure, we have a fight on our hands and this is something we have to continue.
And that certainly is how she built up her career in the U.S. Senate. And I think what she was doing there was really revisiting some of the themes of her campaign this past year and talking about the policy issues as well as about her biography and her career as an attorney.
So where do the Democrats go from here, do you think?
This is a great question, and I think that it will take a couple of days for all the dust to settle. I think that there is both the perception that Harris's campaign in 2024 was a bit to the center of Biden's campaign in 2020, and also that this magnitude of Republican victory is usually a time when the Democrats would pivot to the center. So it's not entirely clear. I think they'll have a lot of conversations about where to go next.
Julia, many thanks for being with us here on NewsHour. Professor Julia Azari, political scientist at Marquette University. Well, let's turn to the global stage and look at the impact that Donald Trump's election might have on the cornerstone of Western defense, the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, NATO, which Donald Trump has criticized in the past. He's complained that many European countries are freeloaders and aren't pulling their weight when it comes to paying enough into their defense budgets. Anders Fogh Rasmussen is a former Secretary General of NATO. I asked him whether he had any misgivings about Donald Trump taking the presidency, given what he said about NATO in the past.
No, the American people have elected a new president, and we will have to work with the new administration. And actually, I agree with Trump that Europeans have been free riders for too long when it comes to investment in defense. We have to significantly step up to the plate.
Well, as we've discussed, some countries, of course, did react to his calls, his pretty strong calls for them to spend more. But there are quite a few NATO countries that aren't spending at least 2% of their national income on defense, something they committed to more than a decade ago. Canada, Spain, Italy, some pretty big countries. Do you think Trump coming back will focus minds?
Yes, I think so. And I think you set a new goal that all allies should invest at least 3% of their national income in defense. Back in 2014, at the NATO summit in Wales, we decided that within the next decade, and that's now, all allies should live up to the 2% target. Today, only 23 out of 32 does that. And it's embarrassing that 9 countries haven't even lived up to the 2%. So they should do that, and we should set a new target, 3%.
What about the conflict in Ukraine? Do you think that President Zelensky is going to have to cut some kind of deal now or be forced perhaps into something worse, given that Donald Trump has been so insistent that he can end this conflict, well, he said in 24 hours?
Well, that would not be a wise thing to do, to force the Ukrainians to the negotiating table. And I think Trump is a businessman who knows that a good deal requires a strong leverage. How can we give the Ukrainians a stronger leverage? We could do that by providing more weapons and lifting all restrictions on the use of those weapons. That would give the Ukrainians a stronger hand in possible negotiations with Putin. And I think, in addition to that, Trump would not like a picture of Putin being the winner and Trump the loser. And I think we should use that to formulate a new strategy where we lift all restrictions on weapon deliveries to Ukraine.
That's interesting. You think that Donald Trump is more likely to do that than Joe Biden has been. He's been very reticent, hasn't he?
Well, I'm not going to guess about the intentions of Mr. Trump. You have already indicated that he has made some statements on reduced American assistance to Ukraine. But I think if I know his mentality, his psychology correctly, he does not want to be seen as the loser. He wants to be the winner. And to win the war in Ukraine, you need a more courageous approach than the approach pursued by Biden.
Well, let me ask you this. As a result of Donald Trump coming back to the White House, is Europe more, less, or equally secure?
Well, I think that will very much be up to the Europeans ourselves.
And that was Anders Fogh Rasmussen, former Secretary General of NATO. People tucking into their early evening meals here in Butterburger Heaven, Solly's Grill in Wisconsin, in Milwaukee. From me, at least for this part of the program, that is it. James Kumarasamy, and you have Julian Marshall in London.
This is Julian Marshall with NewsHour live from the BBC in London. Climate change was largely a dormant issue during the US election campaign, despite America and other regions of the world being ravaged by extreme weather. But Mr. Trump's views on the topic are likely to have a global impact. In the past, he's described climate change to be a hoax, and one of his policy priorities is rolling back measures to combat global warming, for instance, backing the expansion of fossil fuel extraction. He's again promised to remove the US from the International Paris Agreement, as he did in his first term, all of which is likely to undermine the position of US negotiators at the UN's COP29 climate summit, which is scheduled to begin next Monday. Professor Catherine Hayhoe is a climate scientist at Texas Tech University. Does she think Mr. Trump will go through with these election pledges?
Well, I don't have a crystal ball, but we do know that during the last administration, they pulled out of the Paris Agreement as soon as they could. But even more importantly than pulling out of an agreement, they made deliberate choices and put deliberate people in places with decision-making authority to roll back environmental protection, climate legislation and action, as well as taking steps to have a chilling effect on the research and the communication of those findings done by scientists and other experts in the field.
I mean, Mr. Trump must feel that there is political mileage in this.
Well, there certainly is. In the United States, climate change has been at the top of the list of some of the most politically polarized issues in the country for nearly 15 years now. Today, in the U.S., the number one factor determining whether people agree with the simple facts that climate is changing, humans are responsible, the impacts are serious, that scientists have known for decades, is not how educated they are, it's not how much science they know, it's not how smart they are, it is simply where they fall on the political spectrum. Climate denial has become an identity marker for many people in the United States today.
You must feel a certain sympathy for U.S. negotiators at the UN's COP29 climate summit against this background of a United States now led by a climate skeptic.
I absolutely do. And I would not call few people I've met or haven't met a climate skeptic. Skeptics are people who can be convinced by evidence. What many people are is dismissive, in that they will dismiss the results from thousands of climate scientists and millions of climate studies. And they're dismissing this not because they actually have a genuine problem with the science. These same people use stoves and refrigerators and airplanes, and it's the same physics that makes those work. But they reject the reality of the problem because they don't want to fix it. And so I would not want to be in the shoes of those U.S. negotiators, because they know that the COP meetings are about trying to figure out how to fix this problem. And they know that for the next few years, it's very unlikely that they'll have the backing of their country to push for the further action that we need. As the United Nations Emissions Gap Report was very clear on, we are not doing enough.
Professor Catherine Hayhoe, climate scientist at Texas Tech University, talking to me from Dallas. Well, the rising cost of living was probably the issue that did most to propel Donald Trump back into the White House, and the belief of those more than 70 million voters that he would do a better job with the economy. He has, after all, promised to slash taxes and slap steep tariffs on imports to protect American jobs. The markets certainly seem pleased with Mr. Trump's victory. Wall Street moved into record territory. The dollar soared and Bitcoin reached new peaks. The most beautiful word in the dictionary is tariff, Mr. Trump said on the campaign trail. But if he goes ahead and imposes tariffs, particularly up to 60% on China, could it turn ugly for the US economy and global trade? I spoke earlier to Robert Lawrence, Professor of International Trade and Investment at Harvard Kennedy School. Does he think Trump is serious about these tariffs?
Yes, I think he's very serious. You can go back to 10 years or 15 years ago. He wrote a book called The Art of the Deal, and he advocated a 25% tariff on China. I remember reading it and thinking, you know, he was nuts. Basically, he came into office, he did exactly what he said. And so I believe he'll try to do and get succeed in doing what he's saying now.
With what sort of benefits to the U.S. economy?
Well, I think on balance, it's going to be hugely costly. There will be some benefits in creating more employment opportunities in certain industries that will be protected. But offsetting that will be higher tariffs, that is to say, higher prices on the goods Americans import. And in sympathy with those higher import prices, domestic prices will rise as well. There'll be more expensive input costs. And foreigners are unlikely to take this passively. And so we can expect retaliation coming from China, definitely, because he said he wants to raise tariffs by 60% on the Chinese. And he's given different numbers, but they between 10 and 20 on all American trading partners. So I think we could be at the beginning of a very nasty trade war.
He said in the past that China is responsible for the greatest theft in the history of the world. That might be hyperbole, but doesn't he have a point that the terms of trade between the US and China are currently skewed, that Beijing is a currency manipulator and steals US intellectual property?
Well, there are those violations which China has committed. But remember that the United States has already, under Trump and continued with President Biden, put very significant tariffs on Chinese products in the name of leveling the playing field. So to proceed with an additional 60%, after all, it's something that just America has arbitrarily decided on its own, seems to me not to be warranted.
And very, very briefly, Professor, tariffs and protectionism saw global trade contract almost a century ago in the 1930s. Is there any reason to believe that Donald Trump's plans for tariffs will be any different?
Well, I think with respect to American trade with the world, they're almost certainly certain to do that. The question is, will others take steps against one another? Will it spark a more global interaction? And I don't think that's going to happen.
That was Professor Robert Lawrence of the International Trade and Investment Department or School at Harvard Kennedy School. And that's it from this edition of NewsHour. From me, Julian Marshall, and the teams in London and Wisconsin. Goodbye.